Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Hello and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. As always, thank you so much for listening. It means a ton to me. A reminder that if you enjoy what you hear here, I'd love if you shared, commented, or rated 5 stars on whatever podcast you're listening to. Apparently that all helps with some algorithm, I guess, and maybe gets me out to more people. But either way, I'm glad you're here and thank you for listening. Just mention again, like I mentioned last week, that if you're interested in hearing Burke Teichert talk here in Minnesota, it's not too late. He'll be here in Minnesota on Wednesday and Thursday at the Sustainable Farming Association's Midwest Soil Health Summit. I'd encourage you to sign up and check out that if you're able. I'm really looking forward to it. Can't wait to meet him, hear him talk. It should be really good, along with Dale Strickler, Mitchell Hora, and several other Minnesota farmers that are crushing it there. So looking forward to that event. Also, I can't believe I haven't mentioned this yet, but the Faro Cattle Company bull sales are coming up here real soon. The Texas sale is Tuesday, April 2nd, and that's in Cameron, Texas. The Missouri sale is Thursday, April 4th. That is in Springfield, Missouri. And the Colorado sale is Monday, April 15th in Burlington, Colorado. So if you're looking to get the right type of bulls, some low-input genetics from herds and ranches that run their registered cows tougher than most commercial cattlemen, then here's your opportunity coming up just in the next month or so. Check out more information at farocattle.com. Or there you can also sign up for their weekly updates, quarterly newsletters, or their bulletins, which give you bull sale specific information. But with that, I will jump into today's conversation with Ariel Greenwood, and I hope that you enjoy it. Thanks so much. Thanks so much, Ariel, for joining me. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your busy day with a newborn, and thanks and welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here, finally.
Yeah. No, it's all good. I'm just so grateful when people are willing to share time and especially in a busy time when you're trying to spend time with your new little one, it's a special time. So I appreciate it very much. But I guess to start us off, I know a little bit about you from what I see online from social media and your website and stuff, but for myself and for the listener, maybe just give me an overview of kind of what you're doing today, your business, your ranch, and then maybe we'll dive a little bit back into your history and how you got to today, but to just start us off with a little bit of an overview of today.
Sure. Sounds good. Thanks. Let's see. Well, my husband, Sam, and I have a sort of a land and livestock management company we call Grass Nomads LLC. And practically speaking, we just use that as sort of a container for our ranch management work and some of our, you know, like horse, dog, yearling enterprises, things like that sometimes. And our day-to-day these days is we run a kind of a large-scale, high-elevation lease here in northeastern New Mexico that we lease with some other partners. And so then we operate it as Grass Nomads LLC is kind of our management team between the two of us, plus some help now and then. It has mostly been Sam and myself with occasional help from either partners or kind of day help. And now we have a full-time employee that we hired before I had our baby. And sure. We hope to sustain that. It takes about 2.5 full-time people to run this place on average. We found to have, you know, a sustainable workload and enough buffer for when stuff can go sideways, which between drought and fire and flood and that kind of stuff, that always can. But yeah, that's kind of the gist of it. This operation is a little bit over 1,000 cows, you know, plus bulls and replacements and that kind of thing. And we're up here east of the Sangres in New Mexico. So kind of the very southern end of the Rockies. Okay. It is New Mexico, so it can get kind of hot, but because of the elevation, we're a little bit buffered. We go from about 6,400 feet to about 9,200 feet. So kind of the western edge of the southern high plains, and then we go up kind of into the bottom of the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. So It's pretty cool country in that it spans. We go pretty far east west as opposed to north south. So because of that, we kind of cross through some different kind of unique geological landscapes and different kind of forage, different kind of vegetation. Yeah,
Wow.
and then the past few years we had been working in Montana with Cayuse Livestock Company. So that's Wyatt Donald and his family.
Okay.
They're really great people and great to work with. And so up there we were managing a couple of different ranches, running yearlings, kind of for and with the Donalds on two ranches that were nearby each other in the foothills of the Beartooth Mountains. And that was really, really fun, really exciting. So things are a little bit, in some ways, slower pace here, still plenty hectic, but a different kind of workload and different kind of work in some ways since we've been staying in New Mexico as of last summer.
Okay,
So
so
that's
you're
what we're
no longer
continuing.
helping with the management up in Montana then.
Not currently. I think we always kind of have an eye on Montana because it
Sure.
is there's so much to love about it.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I would say, ironically, like if someone wants to be in Montana, running ranches is a good way to do it because it's becoming an increasingly unaffordable place to live and work otherwise, sadly. But yeah, that's just a beautiful kind of country. And this place is beautiful too, but it's a little bit more Spartan and subtle in that respect.
Sure. Well, I want to get into your history, but you piqued my interest there with like the idea of if you want to be in Montana, running ranches is the way to do it. Is that how is that or a way to do it? I guess you mentioned is that like all the people moving in that don't actually want to actively manage their land, there's opportunities to lease or to manage, or how is that opportunity?
Oh, well, really, I'm just commenting on the fact that so much land is, to my eye, getting purchased, subdivided. Some places are getting so small it's hard to run an effective cattle operation.
Sure.
Once you go below a couple thousand acres, really, once you go below, like one of the ranches we were running there was around 12,000 and one was a little over 3,000. And so between those two places, it was enough work for the both of us.
Sure.
But for one person, it's a highly desirable, beautiful landscape.
Yeah.
And if you've got to pay rent there to just to exist and live in a house, that's
Sure.
gotta hurt,
Yeah.
So that's all that I mean. And
Sure.
it's just a phenomenon that's in many ways you could say been happening since the founding of the United States in this country. People
Yeah.
want to go to where the living seems good or beautiful. And I just think up there, especially outside kind of major metropolitan areas or areas that are kind of up and coming areas or ski areas or whatnot, a lot of the range is just getting gobbled up to be turned into
Yeah.
Airbnb or vacation rental homes, which is
Yeah.
a double-edged sword, but sad to see someone who would like to see the prairie open for
Yeah.
as long as possible.
Yeah. No, that's such a frustration. It's probably one of like it doesn't seem like land anywhere is really based on its production value anymore, but the West it seems even more skewed towards the recreational value of it, the beauty, the mountains, the water, the elk and hunting and fishing and stuff and skiing. Yeah, to find anything any remotely close to production value is pretty impossible. And I'm like you said, there's probably mixed feelings on it, but for those who value the way it once was, it's probably pretty sad to see it going more urban.
Yeah, and it is a double-edged sword in that places that can maybe smaller like grass-fed operations that can float their operation by having fewer cows and keeping animals to, 24, 26 month slaughter age and then get a grass-fed premium, they
Yeah.
can probably still make it. And that's where I was got my start in California because it's similar dynamic, similar pressure on those landscapes, but on the other hand, a larger and more nearby market to sell to. And then on the other hand, you have when you have the large or the very wealthy landowners, sometimes they reconsolidate ranches that were split up.
Sure.
And it's almost like any way you cut it, there's opportunities there because they're putting land back together. You can start running larger operations or larger herds. You have more water, there's more movement for wildlife, et cetera. But on the other hand, it's pricing out a lot of other people. So
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of ways in the future we can get creative about threading that needle or finding some third way between kind of smallholder properties that are pretty limited in their ability to make an income versus really large properties that are owned by billionaires where they hire a lot of people, but you're kind of at their behest. Like,
Yeah.
there's got to be more ways to do it. There's lots of creative business models out there, I think,
Yeah.
that could be
Yeah.
explored in ranching.
For sure. And I do wonder if in some ways there's some opportunity, like you're saying there, because if everyone buying ranches were other ranchers, likely it would be some of the bigger ranchers that might do it. It might be hard to compete with them as a small rancher, but if the other people buying ranchers are wealthy people who have no intention of operating the ranch themselves, that might give a guy an opportunity to come in potentially and lease or work with that
Yeah, for
individual
sure.
that you may never have had the opportunity if just the neighboring big ranch was going to buy it and run it in with their own place or something. So there's
Yeah.
mixed, you know, sure, we'd probably rather just be able to buy it, but yeah, it's interesting. A challenge that we face in our own way here in Southeast Minnesota. We definitely have some urban investment and other larger, you know, wealthier people buying land and farmland, but not to the level probably of out there. But you mentioned California and getting your start in agriculture in California. So that's a good segue into talking a little bit about how you got into agriculture. I was curious, like, has your family been in agriculture, ranching? Talk a little bit about, yeah, your start in this or what got you interested in it.
Yeah, well, I started working on farms kind of as my first job when I was 16 in North Carolina, which is where I'm from. I got hired, or I started volunteering at sort of a diversified place that grew some small, veggie crops, field crops, and also grew a lot of perennial plants and culinary herbs and that kind of thing. And they hired me on just as a farmhand. So I did that kind of job for a few years at different scales and different places in North Carolina. And then I moved to California in my early 20s. I got a job working for a guy who is sort of a, he's actually like a, he's building flying cars
Wow.
that I think are actually maybe going to hit the market before too long. I kind of did a quick Google on him the other day, and he had a
Really?
property out there, and it was a well-intentioned place, not very well organized. And I'd say that's a case of a lot of sort of places in, at least in California, that are owned by folks who care about the land and people, come into some means, are very creative, but things can be a little bit chaotic. So I was there for about 6 months, and that was where I first got to work with pigs and goats, so work with smaller animals. And I had been exposed in my college courses and just through some people I met through my farm jobs to, of course, at the time, sort of the small scale sustainable food movement. That was back when people like Michael Pollan and Joel Salatin and folks were just sort of making their mark in circles beyond actual small farm circles. So I got to learn about, through my ecology courses, the value of rangelands and ruminants and disturbance and that kind of thing. And from the farm side, how livestock can play a role in that. And I felt very interested in expanding beyond vegetable production and getting to something that was maybe you would say larger scale. And there's all different ways to conceive of scale. I don't think,
Yeah.
it's not like the scale we're operating on now is necessarily any more important or significant than something that's a smaller ranch in a more productive area. But I like to be around open places and big animals, and there was not a lot of that in North Carolina. It's interestingly, North Carolina, especially where I grew up, used to be more of a open prairie and savanna landscape. And then a lot of people think that the whole eastern seaboard used to be a contiguous forest, and now it's broken up. And in some ways, it's the other way around, where, once indigenous people were moved off, lightning fires were suppressed, elk and buffalo that used to be all the way out there were moved out. Things started to shift rapidly, and then you had trees come in to fill in, and then you had trees cleared for agricultural purposes, and just this push-pull dynamic. But
Yeah.
it if we'd gone back maybe 500 years, I think that kind of landscape would be very appealing to a lot of us who work with livestock now. But now it's pretty congested with a lot of nice trees, but we kind of, they block the line of sight in the sky, and I like both. So, so
Makes
yeah,
sense.
then in California, I finally found, sort of haphazardly found my way to working with a herd of cattle on a that were managed by someone who had a relationship with a nature preserve. The preserve had done what I think a lot of places do when land is donated to, put in some trust or donated to university or whatever, where they removed all the livestock that were maybe not great for the landscape because they were kind of set stock grazed or grazed same place every year. But then they started to see there was a encroachment from brush and conifers, and so they started to bring cattle back, working with a man out there named Aaron Lucich, who had a herd of cattle and needed a place to put them. So I just sort of managed that herd, working afoot and with a four-wheeler and electric fence for about 2.5 years. And that was I went very deep into one way of doing it. From there I was hired by a grass-fed operation that had a few different properties, managed their cattle for a while and helped them build their business, and learned a lot there about some other dimensions of it. And then I got to know my now husband Sam sort of through the small world that is holistic management, growing larger all the time, especially as some of the edges of that sort of blur with some of the other organizations and movements in, regenerative agriculture and livestock. But as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, it felt like a pretty small world. So I moved to New Mexico about 5.5 years ago, and felt utterly useless landing on huge leases that worked primarily with, horses and had huge herds of elk and wild horses and things that were beyond what you could easily contain with, a single strand of polywire fence, to say the least. So had to go through and still am in many ways a process of learning all the things that I, not only skills I didn't have, but still learning what I don't know, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And so, but I'm glad to have been able to work across different scales and landscapes. I think anytime I'm in one, it helps me understand previous places I've worked with better, and vice versa. So that, but yeah, that kind of brings us up to speed to these days, I'd say.
So I'm curious, like you had a progression of several like production ag jobs. Was that a career before meeting Sam that you thought you would pursue as a career in production ag as like an employee? And was that the goal, or like what was your direction at that point before you met Sam and moved to their ranch?
Well, I'd say, I was definitely on a pretty firm course working with livestock in, at the time, more of a grass-fed focus. And I'd say working with Sam and with our business partners here and in Montana, I've certainly appreciated the way that the boundaries between a grass-fed operation and a commodity operation are pretty porous, just in the way that the boundaries between conservation lands and ranch lands actually can be pretty porous. There's all kinds of unconventional people and positions in that you find in ranching that from the outside seem anachronistic or don't make sense. But I would not be, I'm pretty clear that I don't think I'd be working on this scale if I hadn't met Sam. I'd probably be working on more grass-fed focused places of, varying sizes and intensities. And I very consciously felt like I would love to work at a scale or a place that would necessitate working horseback and be, in the, in this case, tens of thousands of acres instead of hundreds of acres. But I tried to be careful to not feel entitled to that, and that was not the main goal. I'd say, insofar as I had a conscious goal, it was not even a goal so much as an orientation towards answering a set of questions One of which was just like, how can we do agriculture to make a living for ourselves, make food for other people, while also supporting, if not enhancing, the landscape and the resource base that we're operating within. And I'd say that's still kind of my motivating question. It's, but it's a, it's a, it's, you know, it's threading a needle. It's hard to do
Yeah.
that.
And so is that you kind of talked about the likeness of, I guess, like a grass-fed operation and a commodity operation being, I think the word you used was porous. And was that kind of what you meant? Is that like you can still meet kind of your similar goals of a landscape management and feeding people in each operation? And like, I guess maybe dive into that a little more, what you meant, just so I,
Sure. I
because I
guess
was.
all I mean by that is just that, many grass-fed operations, maybe the primary product is a whole cow, like a steer finished at 26, 28 months, but they still often will have animals that they send to a sale barn, cows that have aged out of production, animals that just don't make the quality cut that they could tell by the time they were weaned, wouldn't ever grow enough to be finished at the quality that they wanted for their consumers. And conversely, there's a lot of what we might call commodity cattle operations or even conventional cattle operations that might finish 5 to 50 animals for a grass-fed outlet every year. We do a little bit of that. We'll besides our own consumption, we'll sell into a co-op here in the Southwest called Sweetgrass Co-op, and that's more Sam's thing. But it's just an example of how to be resilient and find one's niche. Any given ag operation, needs to be flexible as to what their identity is, if you will, and find different opportunities to just to generate revenue
Yeah.
to stay afloat. So that's kind of what I mean. And
Sure.
and a similar example would be some of the people that you find involved in some of the, say, some of the big like buffalo rewilding kind of things, projects these days, are people with a ranching background. There's a lot of people who are really excited about restoring large landscapes to their presumed former biological health. Who, and that's their main motivation, but they working with cattle because that's what they've had, available. And I've come to appreciate how I really benefit by working within an industry where there are people who are really just all about cow genetics, that's like their thing, or they're really all about feed efficiency or running feed yards really well, or they're a couple of our partners are order buyers, and so they have this whole matrix in their head about the cattle market that I don't understand, but I'm sure glad that there's people with that predilection involved in the beef industry so that I can be occupying my own little niche of it, whatever that is, but feeding into the industry as a whole and hopefully making it better.
Well, it's interesting to me. I kind of had that. I don't know if it's you even call it like a light bulb moment or anything, or just a. We had just a few weeks ago. I was kind of thinking about this. Everybody comes to ranching from almost a little bit different perspective in their own minds, with a little different values, a little different main goals. We're all in the same business, but what we can. Like the example I gave on a podcast a couple of weeks ago was like Will Harris. When I had him on my podcast, he was talking how much intentionality was into the animal humane side of it. Like so much to the point where they don't castrate bull calves and they grass finish bulls as intact bulls, which is very counter to what the majority of the industry has always done. But that was like his goal is maximum animal, life quality. And that's like, that's the perspective that he has. And then other people are looking, like you talk about, from a cattle genetics perspective. They may want a certain type of animal regardless of its ability to be profitable in a real ranch situation, but their goal is purely out of some design or desired animal type or show ring type animal. And we all have different perspectives, and some people are purely focused on land management at the expense of profit, at the expense of animal type. They're going to do what's best for the soil no matter what. And yeah, that's just an interesting insight you kind of made there, just like, and how It's interesting to see when you start to look at different operations and different individuals, what are the guiding principles that are kind of, and how does that play out? And when you look at their ranch, what do you see? What are the differences maybe from somebody who might have a slightly different value set or
Yeah,
goal?
we really all need each other. I mean, it's been a change in my attitude, I'd say, for the past year or so, because I used to be troubled if I was talking to someone, about some social issue or ecological concern of mine, something that was coming more from what motivates me to be working with livestock agriculture, and it didn't resonate with them, or they came back with some totally different attitude that, rub me the wrong way, or might be considered, problematic in some circles, as someone says. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be honest with each other and have hard conversations, but ultimately, I've had to ask myself, do I want to live in a world where everyone has the exact same aptitude and interest as I do? I really don't, partly because that world, it wouldn't function. It would not be functioning. Even the person you said who's so interested in genetics that they get into these kind of more far-flung corners of what can hardly be recognized as the beef industry anymore. Like, they're still expanding our knowledge base in a direction, and this is might seem a little bit controversial, and some people will think I'm very naive for saying this, but I've kind of gotten to the point where even people who are like vegan activists, for example, I might not agree with their motivation. I might not agree with the way that, the level of disrespect that they might speak to someone like me. But at the same time, sometimes they raise good points. And sometimes it's good for some industries like ours to be a little bit on guard and thoughtful about how we're perceived by other people, or to keep an eye over our shoulder for how we might be impacting the animals or the environment in areas that we might be a little bit complicit in. And I think there's a lot of defensiveness within the beef industry because we're tired of being misunderstood. But I think we also can easily misunderstand our critics. And you don't have to agree with someone's motivation to be able to recognize where they're making good points. So I think that the longer that I work with herd-based animals, whether that's, our string of horses or a herd of cows or elk that run across this place, the more I appreciate that people, we're a herd-based animal. We like to think that we're like something a little bit more cooler, compelling than that, but
The
ultimately,
rugged individual Western. No, we're totally heard.
we are, and we care. There's this really good essay about this. I think the author's name is Ben Hunt, and it's called Sheep Logic. I can't find it online anymore, but he's basically making the point that people are a lot like sheep, and in not in a disparaging way. That's often used as a insult, but and I don't know much about sheep, and I know it's typical of a lot of cattle people to disparage sheep, so I'm not going to do that. But just to riff on what he was saying, sheep are often, and cattle, I think, pretty much any prey-based herd animal, prey animal, we're concerned. We're not just worried about our own welfare. We're thinking about how everyone else in the herd is responding and reacting. And we're thinking about their opinion of us. We're thinking about what are they doing, because that's going to inform our next step. Do I have a place in the herd, and so on. And I think, it's on the one hand, it's wrong to use dehumanizing language about people. That's been the root of a lot of terrible things throughout history. But on the other hand, if we use dehumanizing language about people, that's only a problem if we think badly about the animal that we're using, calling someone a snake or a rat. That it's like certain rats are they're intelligent, amazing animals in their own right. Similar with sheep or cattle, they're very intelligent in their own right within their own context. And all of that to say, like, the more I work with animals, the more I'd say grace and patience I'm able to have with people and with myself, because a lot of times we're really not rational actors. We're trying to think about ways to stay safe, to save face as a way of staying safe, to meet our basic needs and feel a sense of belonging. And the same person dropped in a different context, born to different families and eating a different diet would, I would argue, probably come up with some have a similar personality maybe, but come to different conclusions. And so that's a little bit of a ramble, but I guess when it comes to people we work with in the very big thing that is, the livestock industry, the beef industry, I'm glad that if there's such a diversity out there, I hope it can become more diverse because we really are made a better, more efficient, compassionate, intelligent, advanced industry when we make room for all kinds of different minds to be what they are.
No, there's you're absolutely right. Value to other things, and if there's an operation that's doing things and 9 out of the 10 things they're doing is wrong, but there's one thing that, oh, that makes sense, but we never would have figured that out if he hadn't been going that direction with all these other things. You know, like, yeah, you can pull insights and things out of everything. I like the vegan point is a good one. It might be controversial. People might have every bit of hatred towards vegans in general in this listener base, but yeah, a lot of times, while they, yeah, you disagree with a lot of their actions and their motives, they may have some points. And so no, you're right. That's a good perspective to have on everything. When anyone gets a little bit too confident or arrogant in their own way, that's probably a pretty dangerous direction, and you gotta check yourself.
Yeah, and I recognize that there's some privilege in me saying that I'm not currently someone whose operation is threatened by vegan activists the way that potentially some of your listeners are. So it's easy for me to have that kind of philosophical remove. But at the same time, like to whatever extent we can kind of quell our tendency to divide and other people, especially our so-called enemies. It's like the only way out is through. And if so long as people in the livestock industry continue to be extremely belligerent and combative, which I think sometimes we can be, not always, but sometimes we can be, the harder it will be for us to find a place going forward. And whereas I think a lot of conflicts just need some integration and some people willing to bridge the divide and have a conversation. But that takes time and energy, and I get that.
No, I'm curious. You talked about you were largely going the direction of sort of a grass-fed route and things, and you've shifted into more of a commodity scaled commodity enterprise. From your perspective and your experience, are there's I'm sure there's advantages to each, but what's I get to say what's better is not a fair question, but what are your thoughts on the two? And for somebody considering getting into animal agriculture, is there one that is a better route to focus on, or what are your thoughts on the Before we hear Ariel talk a little bit about her perspectives on grass finishing versus more of a commodity beef program, if you are grass finishing and marketing that meat direct to consumer, or if you're grain finishing, or if you're selling pork or poultry or lamb or whatever else that you might be marketing, you need to have a good website. And the website program that we use is Barn to Door. Barn to Door is an all-in-one solution built for farmers to help you manage all of your direct sales, both online and in person. And my wife and I now have been using them for several years. And with Barn to Door, we've actually been able to build consistent recurring cash flow with subscriptions to our farm products. But most importantly, Barn to Door has helped us save time by simplifying order management. And if you're looking to get time back with your family while operating a successful farm business, I'd encourage you to check out Barn to Door. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, where you can learn a little bit more about how we've used them on our farm. And if you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session. Again, that's www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter.
I mean, I think for me, it's mostly been following opportunity and circumstance. One of the advantages of smaller places, like I said earlier, that are located near more populated areas and maybe where ranches are smaller but more productive, those are good places to get your start because I'd say the barrier to entry in terms of skills can be a little bit lower, in the sense that maybe you need to know how to ride a four-wheeler, but you don't need to know how to, doctor a cow horseback right off the bat, And at the same time, there's a lot of principles in the work that are critical no matter where you are. And, people could spend their whole lives on a so-called small-scale place and find there's still more to learn and still more to do. And it's funny how like rainfall just mediates so much. You know, the more rainfall there is, or the more effective rainfall there is, the more complex a place can be for any given acre, you know. So those are the places that were willing to take a chance in hiring someone like me who had a tremendous amount of interest. But, you know, I grew up having some horses and I grew up very rurally and I'd worked in different kinds of agriculture. I like to think I had some common sense, but I know very much what it's like to come into a job or a landscape and have just no context. I mean, an example is just today. So I'm doing some, like I said, some light carpentry outside, like taking the baby in and out and, you know, putting her in the car when I need to run the circular saw, that kind of thing. Like just kind of just building some shelves so we're a little more organized around here. And I realized like I've never used a speed square before. I'm like right before this interview, I'm trying to figure out how to use a speed square which, you know, I think is a pretty basic carpentry tool for a lot of people. I don't know how to use it. I'm sure once I figure it out, it'll make total sense. But it's the same feeling of just like staring at this thing, kind of being able to use it, but knowing I'm not really using it how it's intended, you know, figuring out the angles and all that kind of stuff, and the using it as it's designed as opposed to just like a straight line to trace with, you know. And I was thinking, like, this is so familiar. It's the feeling of being out of your depths, but looking at something, knowing it's the next thing, knowing it's an essential tool. And then, you know, it's like if you get into some new country and you're on a new ranch and you're like, I have no idea where I am. I can hardly tell which way I came from. And then after a couple weeks of being there, you know, you can, you know, a couple weeks, couple months, depending on the place, but you can move across the landscape in your mind, you know. It's just, and that to me is, it's part of the fun of ranching, of course, because there's no matter what the spatial scale you're on, there's endless scope and depth for growing your skill set and becoming more effective. But it's humbling when you run up against that feeling of like, I don't know, and I don't know what I don't know. Hopefully by the time this you publish this, I'll know how to use a speed square because I really gotta get some shelves braced out there. But
It's just funny as you mentioned that I'm like smiling because I know that feeling that you're
yeah.
talking about, that the feeling you're describing of just like this, oh man. But it's cool, like a perspective changing towards a view of like, oh, this is the next thing. This is almost an excitement as opposed to an overwhelming frustration or something. So,
Yeah, it becomes an overwhelming frustration when you feel like it's something that you, it's a skill you need and you don't have time to acquire it, you know. And I think it's very satisfying when just in time learning is satisfying, kind of only when you have whether the mentorship to show you how to do it or the time to figure it out. I have a little bit of a buffer period because I'm working part time for the ranch right now and I'm just kind of fitting stuff in amongst caring for this baby. You know, if I was working back full time, I'd be like, I just need to get someone to show me this because I can't take, you know, an hour to puzzle at it.
Bet you had a lot of those feelings once you started the motherhood journey too, trying to
Yeah, for
figure out,
sure.
oh man, but
For sure. I will say I've been pleased at the degree to which animal husbandry relates, and not in any specific thing so much as you know, with the tending aspect of taking care of land and animals, of just like you kind of do something, you go away, and then you come back and you do something else and you check in. That kind of tempo fits very well with being a first-time parent with a new infant. I feel bad for people who have kids who have never cared for a living thing besides themselves before. I think it would be really hard to get in that program.
That's a good point. I hadn't considered our experience as caretakers as relevant to our experience now being parents in my particular situation and stuff, but I bet you there's probably a lot of truth to that and just the value it brings. But yeah. So I'm curious more about your ranch today that you're managing in New Mexico there. And I think I share a lot of the same interests in you of like big spaces, open sky, beautiful country like that. But I've often thought, I was like, if I was ever going to go work on a place out west like that, I could go in and say, I have experience running hundreds of cows, but in honesty, it's totally different. I like in Minnesota, Southeast Minnesota, where I'm at, higher moisture, hundreds of acres instead of tens of thousands of acres. If I was going to go out there and tell them that I'm somehow capable of running a ranch like that, that would be a complete lie. Even if I've gone from being a manager of a ranch here to managing in a context like that, is it's just totally different. So how has that changed? And you didn't step into the management role necessarily, but still you were jumping into something totally different.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the let's see, there is a lot that's very similar, but then how you enact it is different. So, for example, I'm sure you can gather a pasture in a low stress way with the tools at your disposal and the cattle in front of you. What often changes, and I'll speak to like the kind of readjustment I've had to do going back and forth between the 15,000 acres we were taking care of in Montana the summer to this place is 120,000 acres. So there are pastures here that are we've subdivided some, but there's still one pasture that's the size of one of the whole ranches in Montana. It feels different because the more complex and topographically complex, the more trees, et cetera, a place has, the bigger it feels to me. But it's so much of this job, it's weird because it's like even though things maybe are a little bit slower paced, you might do a couple of categorical things all day. So like checking water and putting out mineral, that might take you all day, depending on how many pastures or animals you're checking or how many herds are running, which depends on the time of year. But on the other hand, you still have to work efficiently. It's you can't get complacent and just drive around slowly or just goof off on your phone or spend too long staring at a problem that you need to come back with more tools or whatever because there's more country to get around, So that's part of it. It's pretty interesting here because historically this place was, as I understand it, up until this kind of mega drought started around 30 years ago, this place was a snowy high elevation kind of mountain landscape. A lot of the villages around here are still spring fed and some of their springs are drying up because there's basically the collection area for their aquifer is snowpack is fed by snow melt that we're not getting the snow back anymore. So it's changing rapidly. Another example, there's a huge shallow lake on this place. And I was talking to the outfitter here who runs the hunting. He's been here for about 30 years. When he got here, that place was fed by a 45-gallon minute spring and it was stocked with brown trout. Now it barely catches some runoff. You wouldn't imagine that that ever held water. And that's within my lifetime, That's a dramatic change. And so it's challenging to run cattle on a large scale where everything's kind of slower but bigger in a way. And I don't know exactly how to describe that, but your cycles of adjustment and correction are over a longer period of time. It takes longer to get a meaningful change in the range. But on the other hand, every bit of extra ground cover or cool season grass or whatever that you get growing is multiplied by that many more acres. And so it matters, Right now, this week has been in the 60s and red flag winds all week in mid-February, late February. 2 years ago, we were fighting a grass fire on a 15-degree day. It was so cold that the volunteer fire department engine showed up with frozen hoses because in the drive there, just to give you an idea. And that's pretty much everywhere across the West. I mean, I'm sure even where you are, not being quite so far west, you still have you're seeing some big changes. So that's increasingly, I don't know if this is totally answering your question, but I'm trying to look around the bend as a livestock operator and land manager and think, what are the skills and practices and tools that I need to have that maybe aren't emphasized right now, but that will be are important now and be increasingly important going into the future. And I mentioned at the start before we started recording that I have a rapidly growing interest in what you might call rangeland hydrology. Some of your listeners who actually studied range science in school might know more than I do, because that's kind of like a, I think that's a course in a lot of places. It's probably a textbook I should buy. But for us here, to give you an idea, as you may know, for every inch of rain, on an acre, an acre inch, that's over 27,000 gallons of water on that acre. Multiply that across this place. If, say we got 1 inch of rainfall or equivalent snow melt across the whole ranch, that's 3.5 billion gallons of water.
Wow.
So what are we doing with that?
Yeah.
And is that water an asset to this place? Is it infiltrating, growing grass, and also hopefully getting below the grassroots and into the aquifers or into the rock layer below to contribute to water security down the line? Or is it not only running off, but taking our soil with it and our seed bank with it, and that's a function of kind of the more the background of our management being, land grazing and how much do we leave behind? What is the nature of the grass that we leave behind? Is it litter? Is it standing? How does that interact with the forces here, like wind and rain and hail? It's also a function of stuff beyond our control to some degree, like the elk herd here, so-called range pests, like caterpillars, grasshoppers, fire. But those kinds of things, I think there are forces that have been operating kind of in the background on a lot of ranches, and we kind of address symptoms of hydrological dysfunction. But I think increasingly, the more proactive we can be in places that are getting a little bit more erratic in our rainfall and have deluge cycles followed by drought cycles and vice versa, I think that's only going to benefit us, and the more we do now to address the health of our range relative to just how water moves across it, the better position we'll be in the future. I don't know if that answered kind of what you were asking about. I'm happy to get back to more the
No.
crux of your question if need be. But
Well, that is more of an intriguing question to me because you mentioned like the I forget exactly how you said it now, but overgrazing, essentially, it was just like it takes a lot longer to maybe fix mistakes or to make change and stuff. And I think about, how here, if I overgraze a pasture, it'll regrow in 30 to 45 days, and I can, I'm like safe for the next rainfall kind of a thing. And it's already growing back within a couple of days, as opposed to yours. If you overgraze or you make some mistake, you're out of luck for a year or years likely. And so, I mean, on one hand, it's almost like it's almost like depressing, it sounds like to me, of just like, how do we even make meaningful change if, if in my lifetime, or if this is going to take me years or decades to make any sort of significant change, it's like, is it even worth it? I don't know. That's a feeling that I almost felt listening to you talk about that. But how do you look at that? Is it, do you see opportunity to make rapid enough change to justify the hassle? Or is it just you're looking out generations and saying decisions we make today are going to impact your kid or
Good
something?
question. Well, I will say having a kid definitely it clarifies some things for sure, and I'm sad for her that she's born into a world and time when, you drive around and you don't see a windshield covered in smashed bugs as much anymore. I mean, that's just a crazy change from, and of course I'm living in a different area, but even so, it's an interesting change from when I was a kid. Just stuff changing rapidly underneath our feet. And, I'm sure you've heard the term shifting baselines. It's where we get used to the present, to where we lose sight of the change. But I think I'm just the kind of person where, one thing I like about this sort of semi-arid place in New Mexico is the problems are clear, and so the challenges are clear. And Montana has its challenges for sure also. I mean, we had everything from fire to flood up there, but when you see green, it fixes stuff. It just feels good when you see a place growing back green, like you said, even if it's not the species you want or the right time. Here, we're lucky in that this place doesn't have much pressure from, non-native or invasive species, and so when you see green, it's generally a good thing. Sometimes I'm ha unhappy when you get green early and then the elk just eat it. They're not good at respecting a grazing plan. But it's just that thing where maybe you're getting much more incremental change, but you multiply it across the scale of this place and it can amount to a lot. And so it feels meaningful. And if it feels worthwhile. I think what happens is your expectations and your lens and sort of the level at which you're paying attention has to change. So sometimes you got to really look to see that positive change. And I will say it's the challenges here, like the sort of epic drought that the Southwest is in and has been in for a few decades now, I think they say. And who's to say if that's just a cycle or if that's just how it's going to be from
So I
now
was
on?
going to say, is it even drought then, or is it just the
Is it even
normal?
drought if that's what it is? Yeah. I keep thinking like I got to this place like a couple decades too late. But then again, I don't know any different. And so, if we get, we got a 500th of an inch of rain overnight, and it's like, dang, that's nice. That'll give a little re-up where, we should be getting like 8 inches of snow right now. Which I guess, in terms of moisture equivalent, might not be that much more, but even so, it's kind of spooky how fast things are changing right now. But that being said, like again, it's part of why I think I've undergone an attitude adjustment about the kind of people we work with and how it's easy to focus on what you disagree with other people or wish that they care more about the things that you cared about. When there's plenty of people, when you can say, I'm not going to talk to you because I got all these other people here, there's just not that many people, and our business partners are why Sam and I can work on this scale, and so those relationships are never perfect. We're never exactly checking each other's boxes, or we're never everything that we wished that we could be for each other, and vice versa, but ultimately, we need each other to be able to navigate all of the things that are going on in the background in terms of weather, climate, and I mean that also in terms of, the political climate and the market and all those changes. So it's kind of like I've noticed in areas I've lived that are higher density with have more people, there's more factions, it seems like, in areas where there's fewer people and maybe feel like you're up against it a little bit more. There's more reason to be neighborly because you need each other, plain and simple. There's fewer neighbors, so you got to keep an eye on each other a little bit more in a good way.
So I'm interested there, and I maybe missed you talk about it earlier, but you talked about your business partners. And I think you talked about being on leased land. Is this like, what do they call those shared lease? Like, is this government land or private public land that you have like some sort of a shared lease? Or what does the structure of business partners and leased land look like
Sure.
there?
This place is really cool in that it is all contiguous aside from a couple county roads or highways that run through it, which help us a lot to get around it. But it's all contiguous and it's all privately owned deed property. So our relationship with the owners is good. They're fairly absentee, but they invest in the place, and we work mainly with one of their agents, sort of their representatives, who is very much a numbers guy, not in the sense that he only values things for their, economic value, but he likes spreadsheets as much as we do, And so Sam in particular is really good at translating things to him in a way that he can see and appreciate. And for the size of the place, it's pretty efficient. And they had, before the place went to lease 5 years ago, almost 5 years ago, they had done some kind of like core improvements in some of the fences and some of the water systems, which we've just built on since then through a mix of NRCS funding and support from the owners, wanting to invest in that infrastructure. And, that's the nature of things here in this sort of semi-arid country where we get, the average used to be 15, 16 inches of rainfall here a year. It seems like it's more like 12 these days, if there was a average from the past 10 or 15 years. And we have a little bit of live water. That being said, the live water is so precious, it's pretty important habitat, and so we've done a lot of work to try to protect and enhance those streams. So most of our water is water that's held in, what we call dirt tanks, so basically stock ponds. held in little puddles just because of the lava rock geology out here, old buffalo wallows, and the rest is wells and pipelines. And so a lot of the improvements we've been doing is just connecting pipelines, making them more redundant, being able to shift our water sources around. And that's really that's the name of the game in places like this if you want to put herds together and not just have cattle scattered out, 50, 100 head per pasture, the way that these places used to be run back when it rained a lot more, and that kind of worked,
Well, that's awesome that it's privately owned, because that was going to be my next question, is how do you manage the land in the way you want, working with government leases that seem to be pretty picky, but that's not the case. So that's really nice that you have the flexibility and support of the landowners in this situation. But still, I guess, do you want to dive a little more into how you've, even with their support, how are you managing for, I'm always curious on those kind of vast landscapes specifically, how you get cattle to utilize all of the pieces of the ranch when they're generally not going to walk that far away from water or something like that. That's one of my biggest questions. But any other pieces of your management that have allowed you to, improve your, that you're working towards to improve the land and your management?
I mean, we plan our grazing pretty rigorously, and I'd say, we're not only planning for plant recovery, we're also planning for changes in our season of use as much as possible year to year. And I think that's part of why we've been able to see a pretty significant uptick in our cool season grasses, which this kind of country, the bulk of the feed is going to be warm season grasses such as blue gramma grass. That's kind of It's the one that's been the most resilient to overgrazing, and so that's why it's here in such abundance, because this place got pretty beat up for a long time, I think it's fair to say. But cool season grasses, like, they're starting to come up right now, right when the cattle could really use a protein kick here in their third trimester, and they can start to put on condition rapidly, even though in terms of the bulk feed, that's maybe like 3 to 5% of the total composition of the range. So the more that you get of that, it's disproportionately helpful to the animals, all the animals, but especially the cattle, which is, what we're really raising here. And distribution then is pretty important because, as cattle will loaf around water in a lot of contexts, and they might go away for a while but then come back. And so it's almost like they're regrazing, even though they're getting around the pasture, they're getting around it in a way that's just regrazing the same plants, So we have a few different strategies for that depending on the time of year and the class of cattle, but we use attractants such as, some years it's been lick tubs. We're actually using some syrup these days with syrup feeders that we found is cost effective, and actually is helping some of our herds of cows. We have two main herds of cows, helping them use some of the older feed or far flung corners of the pasture a lot better. So it's a hassle, but it's Sam did a whole spreadsheet looking at our different options, and he's felt like, even considering the wear and tear on vehicles and the hassle it takes to put out every, 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever, it's still worth it for cow condition, the cost savings, and the way that they can utilize their range better. Because, like Google Earth has a good tool where you can draw a radius of outside of your water sources to see, how far away they or where you might need to space them, assuming that they are not likely to go much beyond a mile on average. So we've used that some to determine where we've run new pipelines and water sources or new fence lines. We've moved some waters to fence lines that weren't there before. And then, we also just of course we are always working on our genetics kind of in the background, and we select more carefully for our maternal herd than we do for our commercial herd because we keep our replacements from our maternal herd. But that's always improving all the time. We're not as aggressive about that as some operations are, and that's just because, we have to be commercially viable, in the interim while we're making that perfect cow. And also things change all the time, so what's the perfect cow now might be changing and then change back again faster than you can get your herd to adapt. So that's going on too. But we also do quite a bit of riding during the growing season and even right now during the winter to shift cattle around. I wouldn't say we're exactly placing them, you know, at some far corner of a pasture where they wouldn't like to be otherwise, but we are able to move them calmly and get them settled in a different, either at a different set of attractants or take them to some feed they might not have found on their own, or to some, you know, some kind of warm windbreak or shelter, some nice place to be, or even just getting them to where they're watering off of a different water point and anticipating them what kind of country they're going to graze off of that. And that's, you know, that's to me one of the best ways to spend the day is just to, you know, take a horse and a dog or two and go out and put some cattle together as calmly as you can and get them moved and get them settled and see that they decided to stick around where you put them for a while, or not, and then you learn what you might have done wrong, you know. But so it's kind of a suite of different strategies we have. And you know, then there's things like you might get hailstorm that comes out and knocks out some of your feed, and then you got to adjust. This size of the place and where we are relative to the mountains means that you do have these big forces coming across. And but on the other hand, because this ranch is oriented east-west, it even if 40,000 acres didn't get much rain, we have some options because the whole ranch, you know, that wasn't the case for the whole
That's
place, you
wild.
know.
That is wild. I just always get blown away because to give you context of ours, like we run total of 900 acres, of which we could probably run 500 cows, and you're running a
That's
thousand
amazing. That's
acres on
so productive.
120,000. It's totally different context and definitely have our challenges, but just
Yeah,
at least
your
talking about, oh,
cows
we have
per
40,000
acre.
acres that didn't get a lot of rain, but this 40,000 over here, oh, we're okay. That's
Yeah, you're thinking
wild.
more in terms of pretty much cows per acre and we're acres per cow. Yeah.
Little different context for sure, but super cool. And so you also mentioned there that got me interested in your cow genetics and your herd, and you have, it sounds like, maybe two herds, sort of a maternal bred one and then a commercial kind of terminal cross herd. Or how do you
Yeah,
how
exactly.
yeah can you
Yeah.
that's interesting.
That's kind of how it's worked out here. You know, as you get to a new ranch, a new country, you're coming in. We came in with cows that we had on a different lease. So a smaller cow herd and brought most of those and then added since then. And well, I added that first year to kind of meet the lease requirements and then pretty much stayed roughly stable since then. We've most of the cattle we have now are replacements from our own herd. We have purchased some outside cattle on a few occasions since then, but some of that's just like there's a big old mountain kind of in the middle of this ranch, and it limits movement for us in terms of just getting trucks and trailers through. You can do it, but it's a little bit, you know, there's one place that's like a pretty steep, windy hill with a sand trap at the bottom. And so you don't, you know, cattle are kind of on one side or the other. And, you know, to spare you going into the weeds too much, some of the number we've run and how we run them depends a little bit on these topographical features and then how that influences the practicality of management and just movement of us. But so there's sort of like a western piece of this ranch that works out to graze with around 300 cows, works out in terms of the forage and the water. Some years that is pretty easy, other years it takes a bit more active management, you know, moving, herding them around or distributing them, getting them up and down some kind of cliff sides. That can be kind of fun. And then, you know, east of that mountain I mentioned is larger, more open country. And so that's where we have most of the cattle. So that's a little bit larger commercial herd that is, like you say, kind of a terminal cross. We use growthier bulls with them and don't keep as many heifers out of them, if any. And then we have more of our bulls and our wean calves. And so some years we herd the calves from the maternal herd east quite a few miles. Other years we have them trucked over. Just kind of depends on a lot of different things. But yeah, so that's kind of how it's worked, and it's fun. To me, that's That's kind of the biggest fun when you get into new countries, is you're so sure of how you're going to run it, and then you run it the first year and it's like, well, I kind of see why the previous people did it this way. We're not going to do it this way, but we can take a few pages from their book, you know. So much of it comes down to just how much time do you have in a day, and what's the most efficient way to move, just to move things around, yourself or the animals or vehicles or whatever, you know.
Just a random question that it made me think here. How many miles is east to west are you stretching and like north to south?
It's about 27 miles east to west, tip to tip, and but north to south, it's I think an average of probably on average 9 to 10.
Wow. So I can't complain as much as I've always complained because we have pasture spread out on 8 different sites, spread 10 miles west to 13 miles northeast. And I'm like, we got to drive all over the place. Well, you got to drive that far just to get on your one contiguous piece. So it's not,
But
it's interesting. At
part
least
of
it's
what's cool is,
connected.
yeah, it's connected, and there's a county road that runs from the
Nice.
southeast to the northwest that you
Perfect.
can get on with a truck and trailer and go 60 miles an hour on to get over, you know. Whereas if you were to take that same truck and trailer across the whole ranch, you could do it, but it would take you a long time. And
Yeah, that makes
these
sense.
vehicles still need a lot of front end work every year, just, you know.
No, that makes sense. So, the last kind of big question that's on my mind here before hopefully we can, your daughter's being so patient. Thank Helen for me
I know, it's
later.
working out.
Is so you were managing this ranch in Montana. And I don't know if that's a goal of yours to continue to look at operating lands elsewhere in other places, but I'm curious how you manage, like that's how many hundreds of miles away or a thousand, I don't know, a mile
I
away.
think it's about 700 from here.
So like talk about how you manage a ranch in a totally different place, 'cause that's something that's intrigued me as a personally, if something we thought about doing or is the best place to run cattle, Southeast Minnesota, questionable. Whether that's the case or not, maybe we should be looking at investing in land elsewhere and managing it, you know, in a better place, but we don't want to leave friends and family here. And so that's something
I
that's been
see.
intriguing to me is how to effectively and affordably manage a place in a totally different context and environment.
Well, I should say, you know, when the back country Montana was a summer yearling deal. And so when we were there, that was our focus. And actually, when we were up there, one of the partners in the cattle company here would kind of run things while we were gone. That being said, Sam was still pretty involved, not in the day-to-day, but I'd say the week-to-week, in keeping tabs on things. And we would kind of write the grazing plan that they would do their best to kind of implement. It worked okay. We were grateful that we were able to do that. But you know, if you're running a place from afar, it really is only going to go as well as the people you have in place on the ground, and how supported they are, and whether or not they have that right mix of direction and support, but also autonomy. You know, something I've seen be pretty dysfunctional is places that are, say, owned by an absentee owner, but who still kind of wants to be involved and has all these desires and wishes. And I know this isn't what you mean, but they have their help on the ground just kind of in a bind because they have these requests that they make of them, but they're close enough to the place to know how they want it run, but not close enough to see why that certain, you know, certain something doesn't work on the day-to-day basis. And I've seen a lot of people, kind of quasi foreman ranch managers, in that position, just walking around with a knot in their stomach all day because there's no way they can succeed in that position, you know.
That's a tough spot.
But I think, you know, Sam, something Sam's been really good at is finding ways to partner with people, even on a small percentage partnership, or some cases, or, you know, like maybe 15, 20% on, you know, a few truckloads of yearlings or something like that. And on the one hand, you know, sometimes those are people who aren't as focused on progressive land management as we might be. On the other hand, you're working with your neighbors, you're supporting, you know, your local landscape and ag economy. And if ever there was opportunity or reason for them to maybe make some changes in their management, ostensibly for the better, it'd probably be through those kinds of relationships and partnerships. So that's been something I've had to wrap my head around, because it's easy to say, like, well, I don't want anything to do with the cattle business unless it's like regenerative and on my terms, you
Yeah,
know?
yeah.
But when you think about the actual mechanisms of how people get to the point of wanting to, you know, think about a grazing plan or even just rest and recovery or think about rangeland hydrology, whatever, it's because someone led by example and they showed them things that could work. You know, it wasn't because someone held it over their head as a mandate or because someone refused to do business with them otherwise. Because in that case, then there's no connection at all. There's no way to connect the dots. So that's so much of how things happen is people with skin in the game sticking their necks out and other people seeing that it can work, you know?
So is there a, do you feel there's a certain scale that is required to justify something managing from afar, a certain level, like labor you need to have to scale to justify 2 employees to do something like that? Or, I mean, is there any scale that you feel is, that you
Don't know. That's a good question. It probably has to do with cow numbers more than numbers of acres, you know. And I mean, I think a general rule around here is that if, like 500 cows to a guy, that is maybe kind of outdated. I mean, it's probably more cows to a guy, depending on, I mean, not this past year per se, but the way the cattle market is on average. And of course, by guy, I mean a universal guy. I mean a
Full-time
person.
equivalent, FTE.
Yep, exactly. FTE, yeah. Places where you can run things much more efficiently. You're either adding enterprises or adding animals, I guess, you know. So, but then there's people, of course, who for whom cattle owners for whom the cattle is just it's they own cows the same reason they own real estate. It's just to diversify their portfolio, and cows are a little more liquid. But I will say I'm glad to be so I guess I can't answer your question too specifically. Someone who's better with thinking about the numbers and kind of the margins would be better than I am. But I enjoy the position that we're in as renters who are trying to make a living in the commercial cow industry and also trying to leave the land better than we found it because it's hard, you know. And it's I feel like if we can do it, it opens up a lot of pathways for other people. And of course we learn a whole lot from other people too. But any of the kind of range improvement kind of stuff that I personally spend my time on, I try to really account for the time that I spend doing it because it's all good and well to say, well, ranchers should be doing XYZ. You know, it's so simple, just do this. But it's not so simple when time is money, you know? And I think a lot of in the sort of like regenerative ag space, a lot of the norms and expectations have been defined by places that are not operating in the commodity market or are kind of nonprofit ranches or hobby ranches. And that's okay, but that set point is not going to be that useful for a lot of people who for whom this is their living, you know.
No, and that's it's an interesting, 'cause so many operations are operating on equity, historic land. You know, you've owned this land, and so you don't need to generate as much revenue or run as many cows or something like that. But in your context, when you're operating 100% on leased land, you don't have that equity to carry through. You may have some equity in cows or something, but you need to, that's where the kind of the question around scale is like in a commodity industry, is there a certain level of scale that you people feel that you need to be at? To take an, I mean, if you jump at an opportunity, say, yes, I'm going to manage this opportunity. It's 200 cows. Sounds great. Get your foot in the door. But then you find yourself working full time and you're not generating enough revenue and you can't make a living. I mean, that's trouble too. So, yeah, it's just interesting, you know, and it's always probably just getting slimmer and slimmer margins or something. But yeah, that's where that question stemmed from. I was just curious, or from your perspective of managing places somewhere entirely different where you can't be necessarily day to day, although it sounds like you were just able to go up there in your context
Yeah,
with
we
that
were able
Montana
to
ranch.
pretty
But
much focus on that, and that was two different ranches, and the way it we kind of worked it was Sam and I would each run a ranch. The ranch I was running was smaller. We had like 700 to 850 yearlings there, depending on the size of the yearlings and, you know, how much residual grass we had from prior year pretty
Yeah.
much. But and I could do most of that work myself, most of the moves myself. I had them in two herds most of the time, unless there's water issues, in which case I would have to split things up and get kind of complicated. But Sam would help me with some like more complicated moves, or if we needed to get a really good count, or we needed to doctor something.
Sure.
And so, you know, I got to where I think I was working about 35 hours a week at that place. And then the rest of my time helping Sam with the bigger ranch, where we
Sure.
had around 2,500 head in
Wow.
mostly two herds. So that was a good deal, because, you know, one place was kind of too much work for one person. Well, the bigger ranch was too much work for one
Sure.
person. The smaller ranch was too little work for one person.
Yeah.
You put it together, and, you know, by
That's
our
cool.
last year doing both, we got it dialed, I'd
Yeah,
say. You know,
that's
and
how it
so the
works,
people who
right?
ran, yeah,
Yeah.
the last 2 years were not necessarily easy, but we knew, you know, with yearlings, so much of it is anticipating how their brains are going to work. And, you know, one quick fix or adjustment on a fence line can mean saving yourself 12 hours of rough
Yeah.
riding, you know,
Yeah.
getting them back or sorting out a problem. And so I did my best last year in advance of the people who were in it, ran it last year, to try to hand off as much information to them as possible to save them some headaches, knowing at the same time, you know, for something that's new to, you know, people who can be really experienced managers, but they can come into country that's new to them,
Yeah.
and you can say things and try to give them a heads up, and there's only so much someone's brain can take in, even people who are the best of the best, you know,
Yeah.
because it's just so much to take in. And it's definitely, you know, and I've been in there too. I've had people tell me stuff straight to my face and nodded and say, yep, got it, but I only retained 70% of what they told me, and
Yes.
the other 30% was actually the critical part, you know. So yeah, that's this place is fun, and it's meeting our needs for now, for sure. And I'm sure as soon as we get comfortable, there'll be some curveball, you know, some
Yeah.
big pasture, some big grass fire or something, or
Yeah.
plague or whatever. Hopefully not, but that's kind of
Yeah.
the way it goes. But to me, that is the most fun, is you get a place, kind of a blank slate, and you try to figure out, given all the myriad considerations in front of me, you know, I mean, that's the value of holistic management, right? Like, how can I thread this needle through
Yeah.
all of these different considerations and
Yeah.
factors?
Yeah. So I one more question did pop into my mind that I'm curious your perspective on. As a I always like asking different people and different perspectives, their perspectives on owning land. And as a lease operator, primarily you're building equity in livestock. Do you see land ownership as a goal? Is it something that you're content and really enjoy the operation owning livestock and leasing land? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, for most of my life, it's never felt possible. It's definitely not felt, it doesn't seem possible now to own a ranch that I would want to work on. By
Okay.
which I mean to own a place of the size
Yeah.
or complexity or just utility that we get to work on as lessees,
Yeah.
or paid managers.
Sure.
I could see some value in owning a small place as sort of a base camp, you know, to keep your horses and keep your stuff, and then go do other jobs, or maybe have a herd, you know, on a permit or on some lease land elsewhere, something like that. I have mixed feelings about land ownership as a whole, because there's a big part of me that just feels like, well, nobody should own land, you know, what a weird thing.
Yeah.
But I, on the other hand, I totally understand that in the world that we're in right now, there's a lot of value and makes a lot of sense sometimes. But
Yeah.
I'm just so used to seeing land that's owned and people treat it, you know, there's landowners who own land and so they value it more, and then there's people who own land and they say, well, I own it, so I can do whatever the heck I want to it,
Yeah.
you know, as
Yeah,
opposed
that's
to
a
doing
sad
something for
perspective.
it. And that's the case with anything we own. There's people behave, I'm not going to say it's two camps, but people behave, some people behave like, I own it, therefore I'm going to steward it. And other people
Yeah.
say, you know, steward it and I'm borrowing it from the future, and that kind of attitude. And then there's
Yeah.
people who say, I own it, therefore I can do whatever I want, and
Yeah.
it kind of puts a bad taste in my mouth about it. But
Sure.
it's something I'm open to in the future if it proves practical. But Sam and I, we have a pretty clear and concise holistic context that we've written for ourselves since the beginning of our relationship and into our marriage, and that we revise every, couple year, every year or two. And for now, being fairly nimble in our relationships and our tools, and as simple as we can be and kind of portable ultimately, that is important to us. And I see so much heartbreak come from people getting so attached to the way things were or a particular piece of land. And that's life. Your heart's going to be broken, and anything you love is going to break your heart. And that's the nature of things. But on the other hand, when we get in that kind of relationship with land to where it incapacitates us from adapting to changing times, that's when I think we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot. And I think about, like, I didn't grow up in ranching. It's a chosen profession and way of life. I don't know about you, Jared, but I know a lot of people and friends of mine are fourth, fifth, sixth generation, ranchers. There's people here in New Mexico who can trace. I have a neighbor who can trace his ancestry back just on, like, the European side, 13 generations. Pretty incredible. But those people, they're just trying to survive and adapt, and so there's a lot to be said for retaining the good of tradition and culture, and not letting culture be eroded by all the forces that do that. But I think we also have to remember that culture historically has emerged from people responding to the conditions of their time, and that's what we've got to do all the time.
Oh, I appreciate that. That's an interesting. Do you fear, I guess you maybe addressed it there where you talked about part of your mission being largely, or your holistic vision, building it out in a portable kind of a way, is that maybe that's intentional planning. If this lease does go away, you have the ability to pick up move opportunities. Is that part of that plan? Is that a,
Sure. I
yeah.
mean, that could look different ways. Sam was part of this cattle company before I met him. So he's, technically it's his name that's part of the LLC. That could continue and go to somewhere else, or that could dissolve, depends on how everyone feels at the time and the market and opportunities. For us, we've tried to invest profit that we have, try to invest it back into things like good dogs, good horses that we could sell, and they'd have a good life and good home. Reliable, sturdy vehicles we can maintain, trucks and trailers, that kind of thing, stuff that we can take with us.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And yeah, that's kind of been our MO so far. I know that when you add a kid to the mix, sometimes that sentiment changes a little bit. So we'll see how that goes. But I'm hoping that we can raise her to feel to not feel entitled to stay in any one particular place her whole life, and to be adaptable, and to feel secure in herself and her community and skills and resources, even if the ground underneath her changes a little bit.
That makes a lot of sense. Very cool. Last two questions. These ones are shorter. I keep saying last question probably three times now, but
Okay. I
last
tend to
one,
talk for a while, so.
no worries. What, like, two, three, four resources would you recommend people check out? And that can be anything from podcasts, books, conferences, conventions, workshops, something that has been valuable to you that you would recommend people check out.
Okay. Let's see. I would say, I touched on the rangeland hydrology thing. There's a whole kind of movement on that front called different things, sometimes called process-based design or low-tech erosion control. Anytime there's a new sort of set of practices, it adopts a lot of different acronyms. But Kivira Coalition, great organization, I think. Sam's on the board. They've been doing great
Very
stuff
cool.
for a long time. They have a lot of great PDFs with resources for how to think about rangeland hydrology on a given property and specific interventions that people can do. So, rock structures, brush structures, et cetera, that are low cost and usually use materials on hand that can make significant differences in the water security for a given place, and simply how much forage you can grow. So I would say check out Kivira Coalition PDFs, because there's a lot of them. They're free, and they're really great. Let's see what else. I'll tell you a book I'm listening to right now. It's called Subtract. And I think some of your listeners, because you kind of get into some of the more cerebral aspects of ranching and ranch management, it's proven to be a cool book to me. It's all about how people tend to we tend to try to solve problems by adding things, when actually a lot of the time problems are best solved by removing things.
Yeah.
And it's kind of it's actually written by an engineer, professor of engineering, but he solicited a lot of his other friends in the sciences to help him answer this question. And it's pretty cool. It's like a whole new paradigm with which I'm looking at my own life and our operation. So that's been good. I'm sure
I
I can
like
come
that.
up with some other stuff, but I'd probably take too long to think of
No
it. So.
worries. I'm just looking that one up on Audible because I like that that concept. I finding myself very much in that perspective now of like trying to remove things from my life to simplify the problem being, yeah, I don't know, maybe stress and overwork. And I'm not sure if it's relevant to that, but just like always been for so long in the mindset of like do more, do more, do more. And definitely in
Yeah.
the mindset lately of reduce, reduce, reduce. So, or subtract, subtract, subtract. So very
Exactly.
cool.
Yeah, same.
Last question then I have for you is just where can people find you or learn more?
Oh, sure. Well, our website is grassnomads.com. And you can contact us that way, or grassnomads@gmail.com. I am on Twitter, or X as it's called now. I'm not posting there as much as I used to, but I'm still on there. I think my username is Greenwood AE, and I am on Instagram. I have a public account there. My username is Grassland Greenwood. And on Instagram, I have a separate account called Working Wetlands, where I'm just kind of featuring wetlands and erosion control projects, wetland enhancement, that kind of thing on working lands. By people who, like us, are running commercial operations while trying to improve the land that they're on. So those are probably the best ways. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. And again, I appreciate you taking the time and thank Helen for sleeping so well for us.
I will. I know. I'm wondering how long this will last, but thank
Good.
you, Derek. This has been fun. I'm glad we
Yep.
finally made it happen.
Me too. The Herd Quitter podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.